It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, should we have term limits for members of Congress? We'll look at the arguments for and against the idea, and you can join in with your thoughts. First, President Joe Biden weighed in on what he thinks should be done about the U.S. Senate filibuster.
Once you stop talking, you lost that, and someone could move in and say, I moved the question of. So you got to work for the filibuster.
So you're for that reform. You're for bringing back the talking filibuster.
I am. That's what it was supposed to be.
Biden speaking there with ABC's George Stephanopoulos yesterday. It's the week in Washington, where we look at several top stories in national politics. In addition to the filibuster, we'll look at what's going on around the U.S. border with Mexico, some historic cabinet confirmations, and where the Biden administration's legislative agenda is heading. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the Senate filibuster? Should it stay or should it go? What do you think about bringing back a talking filibuster instead? Not getting rid of it, but making senators actually go there and talk on the floor to put it into practice. And what questions or thoughts do you have about the politics of the filibuster? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren Gambino, senior political reporter at The Guardian. Lauren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we heard from President Biden there weighing in on the filibuster. How big an issue is this in the U.S. Senate right now? How hot is the conversation about maybe changing the filibuster?
It is the topic of conversation right now. We just heard from Biden, which was very significant because he is a long-term member of the Senate. He served for 36 years there, and he has long been considered an institutionalist who really does support these arcane procedural tactics that have been, you know, like the filibuster, and he has defended the filibuster for a long time. So this is a pretty sharp break with where he has been before. He wants to effectively, you know, overhaul this process and make it much harder for the opposition, or, you know, it's typically the minority party, to filibuster the legislation. And that's quite significant, as I said. We're also hearing from several other members of the Senate, most notably Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell has issued a very stark warning to Democrats, saying if you do away with or radically reform the filibuster, I will wage a scorched earth campaign. And I think for those following Mitch McConnell's career, you know, he means what he says. He's known for his hardball tactics. And so, you know, that was a very clear warning that he could make life very miserable very fast for Democrats if they do choose to go down this road.
Let's give a listen to Senate Minority Leader McConnell speaking yesterday, saying, hey, here's what's coming if you do this, Democrats. Here's a taste.
Everything that Democrat Senates did, or Presidents Bush and Trump, everything the Republican Senate did to President Obama, would be child's play compared to the disaster that Democrats would create for their own priorities if they break the Senate.
And let's talk. We're going to, by the way, talk about the filibuster on the show tomorrow. Spend a whole half hour on it. But this talking filibuster idea, that doesn't mean you can do whatever you want without 60 votes. It just means that senators would have to be talking on the floor. I've seen the case that that could actually be even worse for a party in control, because as of right now, I just use the filibuster to put that issue on hold. If I'm filibustering out loud on the floor, I'm putting the whole Senate on hold. Do I have that right from your understanding?
That is my understanding. I think you'd see a lot more, scenes like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, or famously Ted Cruz reading Dr. Seuss on the floor of the Senate. And, you know, certainly you have personalities in the Senate who would probably be happy to engage in those kind of tactics. So it could be a complete nightmare. At the same time, it would put the burden more on the opposition rather than the supporters. Currently, it's almost a threat. You know, supporters of the legislation have to come up with 60 votes. Now it's all, the burden is would shift in a way to the opponents to really, you know, go through and block this or delay this legislation.
Talking to Lauren Gambino, excuse me, Lauren Gambino, senior political reporter at The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national politics, including right now, the filibuster and whether it should stay, go, or be changed. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us now in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I have two quick points I'd like to make. The first one is that I'm becoming convinced we don't need Congress, the Senate, or state legislators and state senators either. Give everybody a laptop, give everybody a secure connection, and let the people vote on the issues. These so-called representatives are not representative of us anyway. But the second point is that on the talking filibuster, if it could be restricted to the issue at hand, I believe it would reveal just how precious little our so-called representatives in the Senate actually know about the issues.
Tom, thanks for the call. Tom saying, Lauren, if we can make them talk, but only about the issue at hand, senators wouldn't look so good necessarily. So no reading, for example, Dr. Seuss for hours on end.
It's very possible. And certainly, you know, senators do try to defend or make the case against a piece of legislation when they do engage in a filibuster. But, you know, in the extreme examples, often after, you know, several hours, maybe you run out of things to say. But that, you know, I think if you're talking about overhauling the filibuster, that could be a part of the conversation, certainly. But, you know, the caller does raise a good point, which is some of the advocates for getting rid of the filibuster say it blocks a representative democracy from functioning, that the Senate is not, you know, it doesn't directly represent the majority of the people, and that the filibuster has actually gotten in the way of passing legislation like, you know, background checks, which are fairly popular with the American public, but just simply cannot get 60 votes in the Senate.
Thanks for that call, Tom, at 800-642-1234. But Lauren, Senator McConnell has also pointed out majorities change. And if you do this now, we might do something different if we take control. And that's got to weigh on a senator's mind. If I'm in the majority now, there's another election within 2 years always. I might be taking this power and then handing it to the other party. Is that something that slows down this kind of change?
Absolutely, that's weighing on them. And, you know, we could go back just a few years. The Democratic majority under Harry Reid in the Senate did chip away at the filibuster. And that was because the Republicans were blocking Obama's judicial and executive branch nominees. And so they decided to do away with the filibuster for these specific nominees. And McConnell warned then that this could come back to haunt you. And sure enough, Trump wins the election years later, and you know, then the Republicans ended up chipping further away at the filibuster for Supreme Court nominations. And so, you know, we've seen that come true already, and you know, you can only imagine what would happen if you truly got rid of the filibuster. It would just depend on who was in the majority.
And part of the story here, Lauren, is Democrats are passing stuff in the House that they can't get through the Senate right now. A pro-union law, for example. They're looking ahead at infrastructure, which we'll get into in a bit, of voting rights laws. Is there an issue that you think might drive Democrats in the Senate to, in order to pass it, tackle some changes to the filibuster?
That's a really good and important piece of this, because right now, actually, Democrats do not have enough votes within their own ranks to eliminate the filibuster, or, you know, overhauling it is different, and I think you'd have to see the terms of how you'd reform the filibuster, but certainly to just eliminate it, they do not have the votes. And so there are some activists and progressives who are pushing the majority leader, Chuck Schumer, they want him to just keep bringing up popular pieces of legislation to prove that Republicans will not support anything. And then the hope is that that will convince people like Senator Joe Manchin, a more conservative Democrat in the caucus who opposes getting rid of the filibuster, that might convince them that there's just no other way to pass some of these bills unless you change the filibuster. So that's their strategy. I think, you know, like you mentioned, infrastructure is fairly popular. That could push possibly some members to support eliminating the filibuster. There's also possibly gun control, which again is popular with the public, a voting rights bill. So there are some pieces of legislation that might push this forward.
We're talking about some of the top stories in national politics with Lauren Gambino from The Guardian. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Can take your thoughts on the filibuster still. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. Also, questions, what questions do you have about Congress and its reaction to the current situation at the U.S.-Mexico border? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue our conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Lauren Gambino, senior political reporter for The Guardian. It's the week in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's take another caller or two on the filibuster before we move on. Jim is with us in River Falls. Jim, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having this program. Yeah, I think that the filibuster has been used to, keep Jim Crow policies in place. Strom Thurmond used it in, I think, 1957 to keep Eisenhower was trying to get a Voting Rights Act through, and really was gutted due to his filibustering. And, I think it's causing more problems getting the parties to cooperate than it's solving. And I think Mitch McConnell, if he were in the same position, he would get rid of the filibuster to get his way with things. So I don't think it's really solving any problems, and it lets the minority really dictate what the majority can get through. So I think it's obstructive to a functioning government at this point.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Now, Senator McConnell, Lauren, didn't get rid of the filibuster in the similar opportunity. Narrow Republican majority in the Senate, Republican control of the House and the White House. As you mentioned, they did get rid of it for the U.S. Supreme Court nominees, but they kept it in place for that couple of years where they had the whole shebang, but like Democrats do now, a not 60-vote majority in the Senate.
That's exactly right. And that is a point that Mitch McConnell made yesterday, saying that they resisted the temptation and the urging of Donald Trump to get rid of the filibuster when they had the power. And he, you know, they Mitch McConnell was very happy with the number of judicial nominees he was able to push through under his leadership with Donald Trump. And so I think there is a question about what Mitch McConnell would do if he wasn't kind of getting everything he wanted with a Republican president in power. So I think there's something specific about the dynamics of his tenure as Senate leader under Donald Trump. That being said, I think, we just don't know what McConnell would do if the situations were reversed. It is a 50-50 narrowly divided Senate. Democrats want to say that they have this mandate to make sure that Joe Biden's agenda is enacted, while Republicans say, look, they gave you very narrow, the American people gave you a very narrow majority for a reason, and that's so that you have to listen to us in the minority. It's just too hard to say, I think.
Thanks for that call. We're going to move on from the filibuster now. Lots of other stuff going on. We'll have more on the filibuster tomorrow on the show. Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas testified today before a House of Representatives committee talking about the recent rise of the number of asylum seekers at the U.S. southern border with Mexico. I want to give a listen to Mayorkas answering questions from Republican Michael McCaul, a Republican from Texas, who said that the rise in immigrants at the border constitute a crisis of President Biden and the administration's making. Here's a listen to the response.
A crisis is when a nation is willing to rip a 9-year-old child out of the hands of his or her parent and separate that family to deter future migration. That, to me, is a humanitarian crisis. And what the president has committed to, and what I am committed to and execute, is to ensure that we have an immigration system that works and that migration to our country is safe, orderly, and humane.
Lauren, can you talk a little more about the back and forth between Republicans in Congress and the Biden White House on the situation at the border?
Yes. So what you can hear there is clearly Mayorkas is trying to draw a bright red line between the policies of Donald Trump and the immigration policies of the new Biden administration. But, you know, what we are seeing at the border is this, you know, huge increase in the number of unaccompanied minors. There is this massive backlog, and Republicans are saying that it's Biden's policies that are drawing migrants to the border at this time. You know, it's hard to say for sure that it's, you know, these types of influxes can happen with changes in the administration, but it is really hard to pin it on just policy. You know, often migrants aren't watching CNN, they're not watching these hearings, and they are, you know, being pushed for environmental factors, for poverty, for violence, these reasons that go far beyond U.S. immigration law. But the broader point stands, Biden is facing a real political crisis for sure, because Republicans are now seizing on this issue. Immigration obviously is very important to the Republican base, and it's something that really riles up the base. And so you're seeing them hammer Biden for his policies, saying that his rollback of all of Trump's immigration policies are sort of allowing this to fester at the border. You're also seeing Biden being, you know, attacked by progressives on the left who say he's not doing enough from a humanitarian perspective. So he's really squeezed on this issue, and the administration keeps asking, give us time, we need time, we want to set up processing centers in Central America so that these migrants don't have to make this long journey. But again, you know, these sort of message, this messaging isn't actually reaching the people who are making these long, arduous, often dangerous journeys. And that is causing, it's certainly a humanitarian situation at the border.
We're talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Some cabinet confirmations still going on. Lauren, this week, Deb Haaland of New Mexico, the first indigenous person to be confirmed for a cabinet position, Secretary of the Interior, a very significant one. Can you talk some about that selection?
Yes. So, you know, Biden came in promising a historic cabinet, and he has certainly delivered on several fronts, nominating people who are the first to lead their department, or like in the case of Deb Haaland, the first ever Native American cabinet secretary. And it's an incredibly important role. She will, given the history of the Interior Department and its relationship with America's Native American populations. And so I think, you know, she's going to be central to Biden's, a lot of his environmental policies that, you know, that will involve the Interior Department. And that was a big piece of the contentious aspect of her confirmation. Republicans thought she was far too much of an activist, and they were very wary of her anti-fracking positions. But she was able to convince a handful of Republicans, and she did ultimately pass with the support of four Republican senators.
And then another vote today, Katherine Tai as top U.S. trade envoy. This unanimous, nobody voted against, which is not something you can say all that often these days, it seems like. So a little partisan agreement or bipartisan agreement there.
Absolutely. And you are seeing that for a number of his nominees. Not all of them have been contentious, although certainly complete support is truly very rare in the Senate. But there have, you know, Biden has been putting forward a number of nominees that he was guessing, and he was correct, that Republicans could support. However, of course, there are currently Javier Becerra, the Attorney General of California, is waiting for his final confirmation vote. And he was a very contentious nomination for Secretary of Health and Human Services. It's obviously an incredibly important role as we are in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, and Biden is rolling out all of these new policies around the pandemic. But, you know, Republicans say he doesn't have the correct experience to lead. He doesn't have a medical background, and that he should to lead this department. And they're obviously very wary because, as Attorney General of California, he led many of the lawsuits against Donald Trump challenging his various policies over the last 4 years. So he does appear to be on track for confirmation. He passed a procedural vote today. So we do expect him to be confirmed. But just again, it shows you the sort of case by case, slow moving process that it is to assemble a presidential cabinet.
And now you mentioned the coronavirus relief package, an economic relief package. President Biden, Vice President Harris on the road this week to promote a lot of the elements of that. Around the corner next, maybe infrastructure. And this is something that was talked about over the last 4 or 5 years now. What's the talk about infrastructure funding right now?
So infrastructure was so popular, it became this running joke that every week was infrastructure week. And Biden is sort of coming in promising that finally this year will be infrastructure year. He does want to bring forward an infrastructure bill. I'd say the biggest issue, though, is that everyone, all Republicans, Democrats, they say they're very supportive. We need to fix the nation's infrastructure, roads, bridges, online networks. We need to get all of this needs a complete overhaul. But nobody seems to be in agreement about what the framework of the bill should actually look like, how expensive it should be. And so there's a lot of competing interests here on what an infrastructure bill might actually look like. Biden has been holding some fairly high level meetings with the relevant committee leaders in the House and Senate. And, we know that Nancy Pelosi has directed the different committees to begin working on what she said hopefully would be a bipartisan bill. But as of right now, there are so many more questions than answers about what this bill might look like.
We'll leave it there. Lauren, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Lauren Gambino, senior political reporter for The Guardian. We talked to her today for our Week in Washington, looking at what's happening around the Senate filibuster, the situation at the U.S.-Mexico border, and other big stories in national politics. We'll have more conversation about the Senate filibuster, its past, present, and maybe future, coming up tomorrow on the show. And coming up after the news today, two Wisconsin lawmakers have proposed term limits for members of Congress. A political scientist joins the show for a look at term limits, their possible impact, and what would need to happen to put them into place. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at a recent wave of hate crimes targeting Asian Americans. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, two Wisconsin lawmakers are proposing term limits for members of the U.S. Congress. State legislatures can't directly put term limits on federal lawmakers, so in order for the proposal to move forward, a constitutional convention would have to take place. Advocates of congressional term limits say they would discourage lawmakers from being swayed by lobbyists and special interest groups. Critics of term limits say they would make Congress less effective and less efficient. We're talking now about term limits for members of Congress, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see term limits for members of Congress? Is it worth a constitutional convention to make it happen? What do you see as the pros and cons of the idea of saying, hey, X number of terms for you in the House and for you in the Senate? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on today.
Before we get to the merits of this argument, Lily, let's talk about the process. As I understand it, some state legislatures have tried to do this in the past. The U.S. Supreme Court said, nope, you state lawmakers don't have authority to say how long a lawmaker's term can be, a federal lawmaker's term can be. So what would it take to make this happen?
You need to amend the Constitution to term limit members of the House and the Senate. And this is, you know, we've done this already with regard to the limits on the term that a president can serve, which was an amendment to the Constitution following the election of Franklin Roosevelt to four terms in office. And that amendment went through fairly quickly. It had been a norm up to that point that you basically only served for two terms. But after FDR broke that sort of norm, there was a move to term limit the president of the United States, and that happened. And so in order to have term limits on House members and senators in Washington, D.C., is what we're talking about, we would also have to amend the Constitution.
And to amend the Constitution, briefly, I know Congress could start the ball rolling and then states would have to ratify. That hasn't happened. So this idea of states agreeing to have a constitutional convention, I know people worry about a bag of worms being opened up. You can start your constitutional convention for one thing, like a ballots budget amendment or term limits. But then what? All bets are off, right?
Yeah, I mean, last time we had a constitutional convention was in 1787 because they got together in 1787 to amend the Articles of Confederation, and we ended up with the U.S. Constitution. So my thinking, and I could be wrong, obviously, because we haven't had a constitutional convention since 1787, is that if another one was called, that it might end up in the same way as the 1787 one, where the current constitution is kind of thrown out and it's rewritten.
Okay, now let's look at term limits, the pros and cons. How do you balance the arguments there, Lily?
Well, there's always the argument that elections are natural term limits because the voters have the opportunity, obviously, to throw somebody out of office if they don't like them. The difficulty that we have encountered at this point in our system as it's operating now, as opposed to when it was first set up, is that the folks who are in office end up being there for a very long time, in part because districts are pretty safe. And so you do have slightly higher turnover actually in the Senate than you do in the House. But the incumbency rate in the House of Representatives is ridiculously high because essentially the seats that most members hold don't necessarily threaten them from somebody from the other side. It's more likely that you're threatened by a primary challenge these days than by somebody running against you from the other party.
Does serving in Congress for a long time make me, supposing I was in Congress, unlikely, but does it make me a worse representative of the people? That's part of the argument here, that by being an insider for so long, I'm corrupted.
Yeah, and that is part of the argument. And so the argument goes in that regard that we should have a sort of regular churn of people through office, and the term limits will compel us to do that as opposed to our current election cycles that don't necessarily turn over that many people every election cycle. The difficulty is that the infrastructure that already exists in Washington, D.C., is not necessarily going to change with those who wouldn't be reelected or wouldn't run again. So the staff, the bureaucracy, the lobbyists, all the other people who have a vested interest in how things are working would not necessarily change out. In fact, because you would have new members coming in, new senators coming in quite regularly, the staff may actually take on extra power because they would oftentimes be passed from one person to another.
We're talking to Lily Gorin, political science professor at Carroll University, looking at the idea of term limits for members of Congress. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Schulzburg. Dave, hi.
Hi. Well, I wanted to first say that Article 5 of the Constitution has the two parts in it that two-thirds of Congress can recommend amendments, comma, or two-thirds of the states can call for a convention of the states, not a constitutional convention. So get that out of your vocabulary. And she is absolutely right that it would leave the staffers in charge for new people coming in into office. And term limits in itself is a start, but would not have prevented the federal government from taking away Badger Care, for instance, from us, or taking student loans away from the states and just federalizing that. So it's a start. I agree with it, but there's more to be done.
Dave, thanks for the call. First of all, I mean, if it's a convention to amend the Constitution, is it by definition a constitutional convention, Lily?
Well, it is an amend. It is a convention to amend the Constitution. And so in my context of discussing it, as I said, the last time we had a convention with delegates from the states to amend the Constitution turned into to what's become known as the Constitutional Convention of 1787. And even if the state sort of said it's a one-off, we're just going to go and have you work on this particular amendment, there's nothing in the Constitution with regard to when the states delegate themselves to having that that convention, that it needs to be limited to one thing.
Thanks for the call, Dave. We'll go to Gary next in Iron River. Gary, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, folks. The point has kind of been, mine is similar. If we term limit representatives, we just give more and more power to the unelected bureaucracy. We ought to think about term limiting the amount of time you can work for the federal government so we can have some changes made.
Gary, thanks for the call. And there's that balance of power between the electeds who would, in this term limited setup, Lily, becoming in and out of power versus longtime career staffers or members of the executive branch, for that matter, who are there for decades, possibly.
Yeah. And again, you know, you sort of have different members of different parts of the federal government. Obviously, judges have their positions for lifetimes. And so there has been also some recent discussion about whether or not there should be term limits of some kind placed on federal judicial appointments, which again would necessarily probably take a constitutional amendment because you're changing the sort of way that the person holds the office, which is outlined in the Constitution.
Thanks for that call, Gary. Now, I know one of the arguments, Lily, from the Wisconsin sponsors of this idea to bring about this term limit convention is it's having long time, maybe lifetime members of Congress defeats the idea of a citizen legislature that Congress becomes more representative by the fact that we have more normal folks as opposed to career politicians rotating through the office. What do you think of that argument?
And again, this is, you know, this was part of the original ideal and that sort of we got that some, a lot of this from folks like Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, who saw that this was how he thought the legislature should work as well as other branches, that, you know, this shouldn't necessarily be something that somebody holds for their entire life. At the same time that we've had the professionalization of politics in lots of ways for over a century. So the citizen legislator, particularly at the federal level, hasn't been something that we've had for over a century.
Lily Gorin is with us, political science professor at Carroll University. We're talking about the idea of term limits for members of Congress. A couple of Wisconsin lawmakers say states should bring together a convention to amend the Constitution and have term limits for Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you like about the idea? What do you worry about with this idea? What questions do you have? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with political scientist Lily Gorin, looking at congressional term limits. You can tell us what you think of the idea at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Well, I think it's a good idea. You know, a lot of them go into office wealthy, but some of them don't. But none of them leave office poor. They have a lot of insider information. They seem to be able to act illegally, trading stocks that the average person can't do. And I think the real disgrace that most of us don't think about is the size of their pension. I think if you're in for 10 years, you're going to walk away with a $100,000 plus pension. And that's, you know, that's not even anywhere near what the average person could get in the private sector, if at all, a pension. So I think being in office a long time is a bad thing.
John, thanks for the call. John's worried it's a kind of a racket, Lily.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, again, you have the concern with the people who we are electing to make the laws that we live under. And, you know, if they become really disconnected from the people they represent, then it becomes a concern in terms of them actually listening to us. At the same time, the concern with regards to the term limits is that people will have potentially even less investment in listening to constituents because they're not going to be in office very long. And what they're going to do after they leave office, because they're going to be pushed out of office after, you know, six years or 12 years or, you know, three or four terms or something. They're going to try to sort of situate themselves so that they can get lobbying jobs or other jobs that are going to pay more. And so that there's great concern on the flip side of that whole conversation that, you know, limiting the time somebody's in office may in fact make them even more disconnected from the people.
Thanks for that call, John. We'll go to Jerry next in Appleton. Jerry, hello.
Hi, I've got two comments, and I'd be very interested in Professor Gorin's comments on them. My first one is, I'm definitely against pushes for term limits. The reason for that, particularly at the federal level, is since it would take a constitutional amendment, it's extremely unlikely to actually happen. And I think it's used as a tactic to divert attention toward real issues that need to be solved. And the main one that I see is extreme gerrymandering. If we didn't have the extreme gerrymandering that we did, particularly with the congressional seats, then term limits wouldn't be as important. My other comment is, and it kind of the last caller alluded to it, I'm also against ways of limiting compensation for members of Congress, because for a middle-class person, you know, let's say a professional, to run for Congress is already financially almost impossible. You have to quit your job, give up your benefits, and there's a very good chance you're going to lose. So if you limit the compensation, you pretty much guarantee that only wealthy people can run for Congress or the Senate. And those, Jerry, are my comments. Thanks.
Thanks a lot for the call. Let's start with that first point. Jerry's saying not term limits. He's not that wild about gerrymandering would actually do more fixing. He says gerrymandering would do more to fix some of the problems we see with Congress. What do you think, Lily?
I think that the caller is absolutely correct that because so many congressional seats are so safe on both sides of the aisle, this is the case, that if you have more competitive seats, if the gerrymandering was sort of discontinued and you had electoral maps that were actually much more competitive than the ones that we have now, you'd have more competition for those seats and you'd likely have more turnover than we currently do. And so, you know, part of this is having the maps redrawn in such a way so that more congressional districts are more competitive. There's also some discussion within sort of voting advocacy groups with regard to processes like instant runoff voting, because that may also make the election process more competitive because you need to appeal to people, not just as their first choice, but also possibly as their second or third choice. And so anything that would make these races more competitive would likely make the sort of the entrenched capacity that we right now have less likely.
And we talked to a bipartisan group of state lawmakers who talked about instant runoff style voting in Wisconsin. They had their own twist on it here on the show. And Lily, our caller's other point saying, you know, don't cut compensation for members of Congress because then it's too hard for people middle class or lower to run and hold office.
And you know, this was a debate actually at the original Constitutional Convention with regard to paying members, senators, and the president. And it was more about the paying of the president. But there is a, you know, there is some discussion about the sort of salary that you get as a member of Congress versus one that you would get in the private sector with the same kinds of education and oftentimes experience that people have when they run for office and are elected to office. The same could be said for, you know, members of the judiciary and so forth. So in that regard, there is a lot of discussion about whether or not members are paid sufficiently so that they are also not necessarily pursuing what they're going to do after they're in office that's going to make them more money.
We're talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at the idea of term limits for members of Congress. Back to your calls now. Greg is with us in Milwaukee. Greg, hello.
Hello. I think it's a bad idea for lobbyists to have the superior institutional knowledge of government. So if people want to have term limits for elected officials, term limit lobbyists and their corporations.
Greg, thanks for the call. And some people have raised this as an issue, Lily. If you have Congress people less familiar with Congress than and how it works than the lobbyists are, this term limits would tilt the balance of power to, as our caller suggested, the lobbyists. What do you think?
Yeah, and that's one of the critiques with regard to term limiting elected officials is that the various other components that are engaged in the political process may end up then having much more power because they have more knowledge and they have, you know, more institutional memory than the newly elected officials who aren't in the office very long as well.
Thanks for the call. Time for another caller or two. Tim is with us in Menasha. Tim, hi.
Hey, I'm so excited about this topic. It's something that I've been thinking about a lot. I think that we should have term limits on the House, but not on the Senate. Just about that idea that the Senate is supposed to be a better educated as far as how government works, and the House should really have their pulse on how the people feel. And I think that doing it that split way would serve us well as a nation.
Interesting, Tim. Interesting twist there, Lily. What do you think?
And again, you know, the House is where you have this higher level of incumbency, in part because states themselves are not drawn by a state legislature. And so states tend to be a little bit more competitive on the political front than most House districts are. And, you know, we can see some of that with regard to, say, the most recent Senate elections in Georgia, or even some of the Senate elections in Wisconsin versus the House elections in Wisconsin, that the Senate elections tend to be more competitive across the board and then the House elections are in Wisconsin. So it's possible to go one direction and not the other. But again, we need a constitutional amendment or a convention where this is you know, voted on. And the other thing to think about is even if we have a convention, the folks who go to the convention may also really want these term limits because they want the jobs that are going to be open. So it's not as if there aren't sort of vested interests among the people who might go to that convention to work on such an amendment.
We'll leave it there. Lily, thanks a lot for joining us again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me today.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. We also reached out to the two lawmakers behind the term limits proposal here in Wisconsin, State Senator Dewey Strobel and Representative Timothy Ramthan, but they were unable to join us today. Maybe we'll hear from them on this in the future, though. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, everybody's working for the three-day weekend. Some European countries are moving toward a four-day work week. A guest says Americans should think about that concept. Senate Democrats are talking about changing the filibuster, maybe ending it, maybe making a would-be filibuster actually talk, find out what could change and what that would mean. And we'll ask you to share some of your favorite classic movies that we should all check out. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. There's a good chance that this week's drop in temperatures, plus the snow and rain and gloominess, has a lot of people interested in a hot beverage. Maybe you want a hot chocolate or coffee or tea. Or how about a hot ginger ale or a piping hot clam soda? Okay, maybe not those last two, but once upon a time, they're on the menu at soda counters across the nation. As reported the other day by the Atlas Obscura Project, their occasional guests here on the show, back in the day, drugstores had soda fountains where you could order fresh mixed sodas of all kinds of flavors, some ice cream in them maybe. They had a problem, though. Sodas were cold, so they sold a lot less during the winter. The solution? Hot beverages. Some of those were things we think of today, the coffee, tea, hot cocoa, but the list got weirder. One menu they shared listed beef tea or even beef and celery tea. But if you think of that as maybe a soup, that sounds a little less weird. But then on the beverage list, you could get a steaming mug of hot ginger ale, a hot egg phosphate, a hot cherry egg bounce. But the clam drinks, that's where I start to draw the line. Hot clam and ginger, malted clamette. And from the Dispenser's Soda Water Guide around 1909, a drink called a Reeking Smatch. Tastes as good as it sounds with cream, clam juice, butter, Jamaica ginger extract, hot water, and celery salt. There's a recipe at the Atlas Obscura website. If you try it, no need to share it with me. It's all yours. They don't make them like they used to. This is Central Time.